Everyone, I'm back. Testing, testing, testing. I'd like you to let me know if you can hear me. Can you hear me? Can you hear me? I'm back. Testing, testing, testing. Hope the sound is better. Can you hear me? I'm going to just start and I'll wait for someone to write in and let me know if you can hear me. I'm speaking as loud as I can. The volume is as voluminous as it can be. I'm going to go ahead. Yes, wonderful. Thank you. So I'm picking up with reading an essay I wrote that went viral about coronavirus data, and especially a huge story that I'm here to tell you about because none of the mainstream media is covering it. It's the biggest story of the 21st century, in my view. Steph Simonowitz of Amnesty UK broke this story. It's huge. And the story is that COVID data, tests, infections, presumably deaths, have been contracted by Boris Johnson and someone in the government in the US as well to be managed by big tech for-profit companies. Palantir, which is owned by a far right-wing tech guy, Peter Thiel, Amazon, Google, and Microsoft. So I want to explain after I read the essay I wrote that went quite viral on this page about that story yesterday. I want to explain as CEO of a data tech company just what that means in very non-nerdy accessible terms. Because if you don't deal with data every day, you might not understand that this is a gigantic threat to democracy, to autonomy, to our physical health, and to human privacy, to the act of learning, to schools and colleges. If that seems grandiose, just bear with me. You'll see what I mean. But what I want to say before I read the essay is please bear in mind that there can be a real crisis, but that policymaking, and I say this as a former political consultant to Gore and to the Clinton campaign, policymaking is not transparent. It's not A to B. In other words, with most governments, even in healthy democracies, when you have a crisis, including a very real crisis, you don't actually usually get policy that is kind of mirroring the crisis. What you get is policy that is explained as a mirror or a response to the crisis, but often there's a process of lobbyists, special interests, oligarchs, billionaires, getting in there before the legislation is introduced, before the deal is done, before the contract is awarded, to shape and exploit the response to the crisis. So knowing both of those things as a former political consultant and working with legislation every day, and as someone who handles data every day in exactly the way decisions are being made right now and stories are being told to countries all over the world, right? That is data points coming in from hospitals, from tests, from coroner's reports, presumably, that's all being fed into these presentations like Johns Hopkins, Bloomberg School of Public Health, or one on the New York Times, or COVIDTracker.com, and huge decisions are being made on the basis of those. Policies are being made. So I want to explain to you in this, you know, I want to read this essay, and then I want to explain to you how many thoughtful people in the tech world and in the policy world are realizing that in addition to being a genuine medical crisis, this is also a gigantic hack, basically. It's the policy is also an opportunity for every kind of human behavior that used to take place in private or in group settings like a town hall or a church, or in group settings like a classroom. All of that human activity doesn't benefit the tech companies because the data is not being captured and monetized, right? So policies using this crisis, a real crisis, right, are effectively driving people into the hands of handing over every single thing they do in the course of the day to tech companies. And I specifically want to talk about how the data around coronavirus spikes and hotspots, which all the media are reporting as if they are confirmed, right, from sites like the New York Times, from sites like Johns Hopkins, Bloomberg School of Public Health, those data can easily be altered, highlighted, changed, corrupted by the big tech companies. So at the end of my essay, I want to write, you know, I want to tell you a little bit about how search, you know, is innately corrupt, right, or manipulable, and that's why it's such a huge big deal that Boris Johnson has contracted with Palantir, Microsoft, Google, and Amazon, and Health and Human Services has as well in the U.S., to manage and present our data, right? Because the headline I want to give you, and then I'll answer your questions and explain more about this at the end of the essay, is that you can tell any story on a digital site with data. You can tell any story and not even lie. And I'll go into more detail about how you can do that. But literally, you know, people look at these websites, these data sites like Johns Hopkins, Bloomberg, as if it's the front page of a paper, New York Times, in which the reporter has confirmed the assertion that there are this many COVID deaths or this many infections in this place, in this time period. That is not what a digital site is. And Palantir and Microsoft and Amazon, but even me with my tiny little data company, right? Anyone with a developer can take a data stream and manipulate it without even lying or tag certain words in the search function or tweak the algorithm or shift data sets from one category to another, right? Like cough and fever to confirmed coronavirus or, you know, death to COVID death without disclosing what decisions were made about that and that moving around, which doesn't happen in public, right? It happens on what's called the back end of a website or the back end of where the data is managed. That is invisible to users. So now that, so I guess the bottom line of what I'm trying to tell you is that when NHS data or Health and Human Services data about coronavirus was managed only by government agencies like the NHS or like Health and Human Services, they have legal obligations to not tamper with it in certain ways, to tell the truth, to have it be verifiable. Once it's been contracted to a for-profit third party like Palantir or like Amazon or like Microsoft or like Google, there are no such restrictions on how those third parties present the data to everyone else in the world. And I just want you to bear that in mind because it means with this deal, which is transatlantic, right? I warned you like several weeks ago that when a loved one had a COVID test at Rite Aid, the terms and conditions gave that data, removed it from HIPAA law, which protects the privacy, medical privacy of that American citizen, and handed it over to Google. And you have to consent to have it be handed over before they will give you a COVID test, okay? And Rite Aid, when I challenged them, said, we're helping the government. Well, the government has a deal with Google, and that changes everything. And I'll tell you the details of why by reading this essay. It's about an 8-minute read. A note from the wilderness and a pandemic. In very early March 2020, Brian, my husband, and I were in the South Bronx, where we'd recently moved. The pandemic hadn't really hit the U.S., but both of us were highly attuned to events around us. I'd been in the U.K. for Women's Day, March 8th, and Italy had recently gone into, quote, lockdown. Knowing that lockdown is a totally unprecedented step in a free society, as an essay I wrote on this page about the difference between historical quarantine and today's lockdown explains, I was braced for a spreading and unstable world situation. Though I had visits to make later in March in the UK, Brian said, get on a plane, there won't be flights, borders will close, and the UK is going to close down. I agreed with him, and I got on one of the last flights out. Once in Manhattan, we were attuned, like everyone, to the news. Brian has spent 11 years as a soldier, and I've spent my own share of time as a reporter or citizen in combat zones. So we often have similar instincts about when instability, or the wrong kind of stability, is on its way. The night that the New York City mayor announced that Broadway would close down, Brian and I piled what we could into his van and headed out of the city to a little ramshackle cottage upstate, you see it here around me, that I had managed to buy after 9/11 when I had a toddler and a baby and a haunting awareness of how fragile is a city connected to land via bridges and tunnels in a time of war. On our way out, we tried to scoop up various loved ones and promised them that the city would certainly close down. There would be a quarantine. Travel would be restricted. Bars and restaurants were full. But life was exciting. They understandably thought we were mad. We didn't expect to stay in the little cottage upstate, but during the first few days there, we got a call, pay attention, from an Apple employee. This was long before the pandemic was dominating every day's press conference, long before the mass flight out of the city by those who could manage to leave. An Apple employee and her family were looking for a place outside of the city. Now, this was early March, quote, for a month, maybe two, for, quote, a work project. I'd been Airbnb-ing the cottage, but after that call, Brian and I discussed what had emerged and came to the same conclusions. We let our apartment in the Bronx return to the rental market, sent movers to retrieve the possessions we'd left in great haste, and without packing, and essentially moved in upstate. We realized by about March 11th that it would be a long, dragged-out crisis, and that it would inevitably involve what I've been talking to you about here, shortages in the supply chain, mass unemployment, rent-based evictions, the death of small businesses, chaos in the cities, misery everywhere, and that always in emergencies and in what amounted to a war footing, though the enemy was a virus, some people had more and earlier knowledge of its dimensions than others. And as I've reported, Apple was one of the companies that had an early contract to, quote, track and trace coronavirus. I realized early on, too, with great sadness, that there would be a medical massacre in certain neighborhoods. I'd been sick in the South Bronx and written about it. It was no pandemic yet, but the local hospital had a man barefoot with ulcerating sores on his ankles preparing to head back out into the snow. And he regretted that the medic had to cut off his socks to treat his swollen ankles because, quote, socks are expensive. I wrote about the black market in single-use diabetic strips, the black market in single Pampers, the way allergy pills were sold from open boxes in pharmacies one by one. I wrote about the way there were bodies on gurneys in the hallway of the ER in the South Bronx, not moving, faces covered on a normal day, quote unquote, not in any pandemic. Normal in the South Bronx was the pandemic. Where am I going with this? Brian and I are not prophets or especially insightful, but we saw what was coming. And those of you who follow me know that I was tweeting and telling you what was coming very early on because we've both spent time both in wars and in totalitarian societies. America is not used to totalitarianism, and it is not used to war conditions on the home front. So there is acculturation and shock for many people, understandably. But if you've spent time in war zones and in police states, of course, elites and technocrats have more intel when intel saves lives than do, quote unquote, everyday people, meaning everyone else. Of course, poor people don't get a whisper of the help that more affluent neighborhoods get. The shock in the New York Times over and over when Queens and the South Bronx died of COVID in greater numbers than the Upper West Side offends me to this day. How can you be human and not see that that would happen? The ordinary man there in the ER on an ordinary day did not have shoes in winter. The baby had a single diaper. The diabetic had a single insulin test strip. Then what? Everything that happened later was foreseeable. Our leaders just didn't want to glance ahead or tell us the truth. Of course, in a war context, when there is a battle for power, there will be disruptions in the food supply, fake news, propaganda, traumatic media images, warring narratives, class and race warfare, escalating crime, rage, and the wealthy creating new ways to separate themselves from everyone else. This is nothing new in most of the rest of the world. This is Argentina in the 1970s. This is Sierra Leone in the 1990s, when infectious diseases needing antibiotics cost too much to treat, when the medicines cost pennies. This is us heading in the direction of Gaza with curfews and militarized patrols. This painful new life for us in the West is life in much of the rest of the world, the one we could turn our back on through a crazy combination of luck and affluence. The sooner we start to think like survivors of war in a totalitarian police state, the better. What do survivors do? They don't depend on anyone but themselves. They don't await salvation from the government. They innovate. They barter. They raise their kids not to be credulous. They form tight bonds with neighbors, and they help each other. They don't waste food. They learn to have communications that cannot be surveilled. They create grassroots organizations. They savor the basic joys of the day. And they don't buy the government's narrative unless they have checked it for themselves. I'll warn now that COVID, quote, lockdown, and it's a real crisis, right? A real medical crisis, but the policy is being manipulated. I'll warn that COVID lockdown tropes and expectations that are now becoming habits, that are soon to become lifestyles, then memories, to the point where our kids won't remember life before this, are guaranteed to keep people from engaging in the kinds of behavior that survivors of war require. Solidarity, love, new encounters, private communications, hugs. It's a real pandemic. It's often fake policy. That's why I am burdened with worry when I check COVID stat after COVID stat, as I open this piece with mentioning, and see the data fall apart under the most basic journalistic scrutiny. Where are the good numbers? That's when I worry when I read that 10 billionaires have made more billions than before out of their previous billions in the pandemic. Amazon was one of the companies, as I mentioned, with which Boris Johnson contracted to manage COVID data from the NHS, and also the one company that was quote-unquote essential in America, while thousands of small business competitors died. Palantir, owned by far-right-wing Peter Thiel, Google and Microsoft are the other for-profits to whom Boris Johnson gave the COVID data management contracts. In the U.S., Health and Human Services gave their COVID contracts to the same entities. Steph Simonowitz of Amnesty UK broke this story. As I mentioned, one of the biggest stories of our lifetime. And to date, no mainstream media have picked it up yet. What does this mean? And this is what I promised to tell you at the opening of our talk. What does it mean that the contracts for managing COVID data of NHS, HHS have gone to these tech giants? It means that our well-being, our ability to make plans for our own health, our ability to create policy with an exit strategy to this crisis, our ability to go back into the world of sunlight, seeing human faces, embracing our elderly relatives, going back to school, having town meetings, is not, and listen closely, is not in the hands of actual medical doctors at government agencies or even in the hands of our elected government officials. This data is now mediated by vast politicized for-profit big tech third parties with vested interests in dialing the data up. As I've described, you can do this without lying, right? Or dialing it down which digital platforms allow. And I am telling you that as the owner of a digital platform that brings data to citizens, okay? We don't do it, but it is so easy to do in such a way that they and their friends can hedge, short, or invest in economies that they can dial up or down, creating a context of legal insider trading for them and their buddies forever. So really listen to what I just said, and here are examples. If Google decides what news about COVID you see, and by the way, Facebook also censors and manages news about COVID, and if Palantir throws millions of bots and trolls, which is their business, and websites out of Albanian troll farms about COVID at social media, these companies can tell you any story they want about where we are with the COVID pandemic, or the next pandemic, or the next one. You can't check, right? Please listen. People who are gatekeepers are saying we're in the age of pandemic. Bill Gates said, well, if you don't listen to this pandemic, you'll listen to the next one, right? You can tell us that we're in a pandemic without any independent verification if you are one of these four tech companies which are now working in concert in managing the COVID narrative. If Microsoft, Palantir, and Google manage NHS and HHS COVID and test data, they can tell you anything they want about cases going up or down, you know, hot spots, as the BBC just reported in Britain as they go into a new six-month lockdown, right, with no verification, no sourcing. They can define cases how they wish. As I mentioned at the start of this presentation, they can move deaths from one category to another, hide or amplify data sets, or change wording on websites to be more or less scary, simply via digital design. And I can explain this in more detail, but it is literally how you set up the data feed in the back end. You can lift out categories, you can hide categories, you can move data sets from one place to another, you can tweak search for so some results come up and others don't. And no one on the user end, what's called the user interface of that COVID tracking website, which now all the news outlets are going to be reporting from, is going to see how this data was manipulated. But on the back end, if you have advanced knowledge of what's being dialed up, what's being dialed down, you and your friends can short or invest in economies that will subsequently be dialed up and dialed down. Thus, they can determine the near-term or maybe longer-term history, not only of nations, but of the globe. If Amazon is tasked with a UK-US government contract regarding COVID data, it can know when to boost supply chains with a nod when Amazon's buddies at Google and Microsoft and Palantir are dialing data up or down, thus killing off the rest of independent small businesses who don't have that luxury of knowing when everyone is going to be told to stay home and thus ordering goods from Amazon. And thus Amazon will gain all the market share of all those ruined businesses that are just the surviving ones struggling to reopen again, right? And in the next lockdown, in the next, it'll kill them off, leaving no independent competitors, except maybe Walmart, to Amazon. And the West will have one company store. It means we can't trust the COVID data presented in even very official-looking platforms, even platforms with government insignias, in order to make our decisions about something as basic as going back to school, because the official-looking websites are thoroughly corrupted already by the profit motive. And by the way, I don't just worry about data being manipulated to overstate the danger. I worry about data being manipulated, as we've seen, to understate the danger. And here in the U.S., we've seen blue states overstate by moving categories like cough and fever into coronavirus, and we've seen red states understate by hiding deaths, for instance, as natural when they were probably caused by COVID, and that is totally politicized. All this does not mean it's not a very real pandemic, as I keep saying it is, but it is also a war on you. The virus is your enemy from the natural world, and the data managers are making war on your confusion and credulity and fear and need. The sooner you realize you are in a war and whom the enemies are, the sooner we will find a way to survive and at length create peace. But when you look at COVID data and when you read news and make decisions about your life, about the pandemic, which has now been thoroughly monetized, data which have now been thoroughly monetized with these gigantic big tech contracts, know that you are in the fog of war. So please, friends, please be calm, be inquisitive, be thoughtful, be careful, ask questions, check sources. As Brian says, investigate everything, and please be safe and well. So now I will go to the questions and see if there are any questions to me. So many. I think people are really just listening and absorbing, and saying, listen, desensitization, dehumanization. Jane Galloway says, so what are you suggesting? Stop with the fear. Do you have solutions? We are all ears. I mean, thanks for asking. I can't not tell you the truth. So I would love to stop with the fear, but I'm afraid. And I'm afraid as someone who deals with data streams every day. So first I have to explain to you what the threat is. And then I can tell you what I think are some answers. But it's a tough one. Humanity has really never faced anything like this. Before I do that, I just want to elaborate a little bit on what kind of prospects, like why would there be policies, for instance, that would, how can I put this? It is very likely medically necessary for people to, you know, act like there's a horrible real disease going on. I wrote an essay about how the kind of lockdown we're in right now is historically unprecedented, even with virulent infectious diseases like tuberculosis and smallpox and, you know, fatal diseases, the Spanish flu. Whole societies have never been closed down in the West in free societies like this. That's something totalitarian states do. Definitely lives are saved when everyone is at home, but this has never happened before. I'm not making a medical judgment. I'm just saying it's never happened before. And when it's called quarantine, it's not a quarantine. Historically, that's not a quarantine. Whole societies, whole economies have never been closed down. I want to talk about why, what the risk is going ahead, what the temptations are for big data companies. When your child stays home and learns only digitally, when your child goes to school in a classroom, no one makes any money, right? Pearson and other, you know, Houghton Mifflin, my former publisher, and other big data companies have been making money by creating digital curriculum. But you can make a lot more money by pushing all schooling to digital schooling, all colleges to digital online learning, all elementary schools, all middle schools to learning on Zoom. And the other thing that happens when your kids are learning online, and I don't mean to startle you, but these data companies, whoever is managing that platform, can harvest all the information about how your child learns, what your child's interests are, you know, how your child is slow or fast, and can track your child digitally, you know, for the rest of his or her life by then using that information to create a more and more sophisticated machine learning algorithm that will then follow your child as he turns into a teenager, or she turns into a teenager and an adult, you know, targeting him or her with ads or with books or, you know, in more nefarious ways as the medical data is also absorbed by these big tech companies. But it's very much more lucrative to the big tech companies to have all kids at home learning digitally than to have them go to school. Every single minute human beings spend not online, the big data companies see as a missed opportunity. And you have to understand that. So that means when we're at a town hall meeting in real time, right, in real space, which has now been outlawed in Britain, pretty much, even with good ventilation and social distancing and hand washing, or, you know, town hall meetings outside, from what I read of these laws, you really can't do democracy anymore at a local level in Britain. This is straight out of Netflix Social Dilemma. It is. And people have said it's out of Matrix. And I don't want to, like, make those comparisons because I'm alarmed enough just looking at the facts. But, you know, if everybody is only forced onto Zoom to have a town hall meeting, then it means that everything citizens do is can be monitored and surveilled in real time. And disruption can be engaged at citizens who are planning to interfere with any of the plans of the oligarchs who hold the data and their friends. I mean, one example from my life is that I live in this, you know, bucolic area as of March, and there's a bill they're sneaking through to, well, I think they're sneaking through to rezone everything so that it's suburban and has huge, you know, event spaces and parking lots and terrible things. But the people around me don't know. And one reason they don't know is the coronavirus pandemic. We can't congregate. And so all of our access has been digital. And it's easy to hide information like a public notice when you're just getting email from the town hall instead of a letter or a poster up on, you know, outside the grocery store where everyone goes. And so a lot of people aren't aware of it. And there's a Zoom meeting rather than an in-person meeting to object to this. But every single person who objects will now be kind of owned. Their objection will be owned by whoever holds that data. And also it's much, much easier to hide what's really happening. You know, I can't stand outside the town hall and leaflet because of coronavirus, right? I can't tell my neighbors face to face. So it's much easier to get around basic democracy. So the other thing is Amazon. You know, I mentioned that Amazon made billions and billions of dollars in the pandemic. And here in New York State, what I see is legislation using the coronavirus pandemic to benefit these big tech oligarchs and other oligarchs. But specifically, Amazon and Walmart were called essential services. And mom and pop stores, which arguably are less dangerous because fewer people are going in at a time, right? You don't have Amazon workers getting sick in giant warehouses. They were called not essential workers. So mom and pop stores had to close down. Amazon got all that business, but also we got habituated, right, to being at home, not wanting to put on that mask, risk that trip to the grocery store. Let's just order, you know, I ordered meal kits because it's safer. So all those meal kit companies mopped up the money that, you know, the little bodegas, the little grocery stores, the little mom and pop shops had been making because of us all, you know, being at home. And while we're at home, we're being habituated to see our friends online. You know, kids are you know, playing Roblox instead of playing with their friends in real space. You know, we're being habituated to worship online. We're being habituated to, as I mentioned, you know, try to legislate online. And so all of this, and then if you talk about the data, what there is this extraordinary synergy now between the medical data, which is being harvested, as I said, and given to Google here in the United States and also in Britain, and investment by oligarchs who can now, or big tech guys or 10 dudes who are super rich and friends with each other, who can now legally drive economies up or down, right? By dialing up the numbers, presentation, not even lying, right? You can get a policy that says, let's reopen. Dialing up hotspots, you get a policy that leads to, oh no, we've got to close, everyone go home. But in data, just and in investing in the stock market, just a few minutes ahead of everyone else knowing information gives you time to put a short or a put, you know, an investment on the economy. So if you know, you know, if you're Michael Bloomberg and you fund the Bloomberg Johns Hopkins School of Public Health, which is the only site that most U.S. media are listening to, and reproducing in term, and they won't disclose their data sets, right? And someone leaked the data sets to me, and only 6 states are reporting. They're super incomplete, if that's a real leak. But basically, if you're Michael Bloomberg and you know 15 minutes from your executive director at the Johns Hopkins Bloomberg School of Public Health that they either found or are highlighting spikes, you know, across the Southeast, you are going to make a bet on policy that will drive people home in the Southeast, right? And you can do that over and over. And so pay attention to the fact that 10 billionaires made $30 billion since the pandemic. How do you do that? How do you do that? Unless you're Amazon, right? What are they selling that people need, except Amazon? Not necessarily anything. They may have known early to invest in, telecom platforms of distance learning. They may have known early to buy Amazon stock. They may have known early to short the economy. And this is happening globally. So basically, the confluence of medical data going to these 4 gigantic companies and their ability to invest in the stock market and drive policy by exposing or dialing up or dialing down results that are not verifiable, so we can't even tell if they're real results, right? That creates this feedback loop where the whole world is now turned into a legal insider trading money machine where they can close and open economies, dictate people's behavior, drive people home, you know, having already invested in the tools they need if they are at home, you know, manage, harvest their data, kind of eternally. And it's not illegal. They won't go to jail. So that is my presentation to you. Thanks, but I'm at a total loss. Lots of people are saying things. I think that I should stop there. It's a lot of information. What can we do? Well, I mean, number one, all of you need to demand that the data sets always be disclosed and linked to any statement about coronavirus deaths or infections in any news that you consume. And you need to subscribe to real newspapers and invest in that instead of getting free news, which is very easy to manipulate. And you should then threaten the publishers with canceling your subscription unless they link the actual data sets. And you should ask questions constantly. Call the newspapers, call the BBC, call, you know, CNN and say, where are the data sets? I want to check the data sets. What is the source? And if enough people demand that, then publishers are under fire and they realize that people are knowledgeable enough to know that they need to share the data sets. What else can you do? You have to insist that you will vote out of office any politician who sells medical data to anyone, and that all reporting on any pandemic has to come only from the NHS, unmediated by any other agency. No other hands can touch it. Same thing with the HHS. It can't flow through any third parties. That's what you can do, and you can lobby for that with your representative. The other thing you can do, and we're here to help, but it's very difficult, is you need to really understand the laws that are being passed right now, because parliaments and congressional processes are being dismantled under the cover of coronavirus and people being home. It's happened as a test case in Australia, I believe. Australia is the petri dish for dismantling an advanced democracy. It's happening now in Britain with the Coronavirus Act, which I read to you in March, as you recall, and I warned you, this postpones elections, in some cases till 2030. And that was at the very beginning of the pandemic. We didn't know how it would play out. I think you need to read my essay about the difference between a quarantine in a free society and the lockdown restrictions that are being enforced on you now, and start to, I think, really push back at there's a big difference between people taking responsibility for their health and that of their community in a free society, and being very cautious and careful, versus top-down restrictions like only six people are allowed to congregate, and the police will manage it, and people getting fined and people getting arrested that we're seeing in Britain and in Australia. There's a big difference. There's a big difference between travel restrictions, which have never been part of a free society, and the kind of shelter-in-place draconian restrictions we're seeing now. This is not medical advice, right? This is about, in a time of pandemics, successful free societies have shared information and voluntarily put resources in place to isolate sick people from healthy people, to make sure everyone got tests. But there wasn't this kind of top-down repressive management of all human life. And lastly, I'm circling back and circling back. Do not accept restrictions that are not based on real data. I mean, it's not even science, it's just truth, it's just data. Like, ask to see the data, ask to see the reports, ask to see what these policies are being based on. Right now, at this point of a global crackdown, it really, I hate to say this, but we're kind of past the point of, oh, write to your congressman or write to your, MP. We're really in a time when resistance, without endangering anyone, like not going along with it, asking questions, just asking questions is really critical. Like, the what societies can only do now is delay a complete 360 degree lockdown and harvesting of data that is mutually reinforcing. You can delay by demanding due process, basically. If you're gonna, pass a bill, everyone has to read the bill. If you're going to have a policy to have police out there, you make sure that you know how to have an election, which has been postponed, right, with the coronavirus bill, so that so people in power know that they might lose their office pretty soon if they, if they follow that road. Demanding accountability of journalists, demanding on social media that if influential people post COVID data without real sourcing, like linking to the data or confirming the sourcing, that's not acceptable. Okay, Romany Aitken Wong says, I'm from Australia, living in Victoria. I'm so worried about Victoria. In one of the lo longest lockdowns in the world, we had a curfew for 9 weeks, 8 p.m. to 5 a.m. Protest has been outlawed, with police and riot gear outnumbering concerned citizens 5 to 1. We are not allowed to go more than 5 kilometers from home. We have to wear a mask while on our own on a walk, even if there is no one around for hundreds of kilometers. Victoria, I am really sorry. None of what you're describing is, I mean, when there was a tuberculosis outbreak, when there was a swine flu outbreak, when there was HIV, running rampant through the communities of America, certainly, lives would have been saved if every single HIV positive person had been locked up and forbidden to take a walk without police monitoring. But that is not what free societies do. And the HIV epidemic was managed very responsibly, very thoroughly. There was loss of life, but the community managed it without anyone losing their liberties. So I'm quite terrified of what I hear out of Australia, because I do think Australia is the test case. And once you've got these kinds of restrictions, how do you ever get a free society back, right? They will tell you it's coronavirus forever. And It may be, but you won't be able to convene even in very safe ways with your fellow citizens, without at risk of fines or being beaten, to figure out solutions that come from the community rather than from fascists. And I just want to note, as I predicted, during the lockdown, during the coronavirus pandemic, your basic democratic processes in Parliament in Australia were weakened, and commissioners, COVID commissioners put in place, who are basically rich guys, and now your natural resources are being stripped away. So I don't have all the answers. And Romani Aitken Wong says, I should add, we had 15 cases yesterday in a state of 6 million. To which, a lot of people are saying, it's great, Victoria only has 15 cases, and I don't want to tell you what to do with your community's health. I'm not a doctor, and this is not medical advice. I'm only looking at the civil liberties. But I would say, one smart 20-year-old said recently, like, what's the exit strategy? What's the end game now? When we were first locked down, we were told we had to flatten the curve so hospitals could manage the flow of patients. Now it seems like not until there is never again any coronavirus infection ever anywhere will we have life without these restrictions or worse. And if that is the new metric, communities really need space lawfully and without surveillance and beating to discuss that, because literally no other infectious disease has ever been treated that way. Like, oh, there's, ever. There are dangerous forms of, this or that infectious disease. Polio wasn't treated that way, right? And it was crippling people. People were not locked up in their homes until the last case of polio was eradicated. So this is completely new. I don't have all the answers. I've thought deeply about it, and I think I'll just show up every single day to tell you what I see and give you my best analysis, and hope that all the smart people thinking this through will begin to take action. I really trust democracy, and I trust freedom of speech, and I don't have all the answers. I literally have been warning and writing about closing democracies since 2007, as those of you who follow my work, The End of America, know. I literally lie awake nights not knowing, how to even save the people I love from what I've seen here. But I have to believe that in sharing this with you, I trust that you will help me find answers, and I will help you. And as long as we can speak to each other, there's hope. So tune in tomorrow at 4. And the books are The End of America. If you want to see how these power grabs originated, the book is Outrages, Sex, Censorship, and the Criminalization of Love. The website is Daily Clout. That's where we explain legislation to people. But it's literally just me on Facebook, doing my best, and I'll answer all your questions every day. I hope this was helpful. Please know that if we work together, great, great challenges have been overcome in the past. Thank you, Naomi Wolf.